Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Lee Boyce today is Helen Crane. And coming up, OVO comes under fire again over wrong billing, British Gas is in the spotlight for bumper profits, and the industry as a whole gets blasted by its regulator over poor customer service. Just another week in the world of energy. Also today, crisis hit NatWest is winning the switching battle. And it's not just Farage being debanked, Crane is back on the case. And inheritance tax, there are noises it might be scrapped, but the Treasury is raking even more money from it. Will it go? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, if you have an issue with your energy provider, you can just get in contact with their customer service department and they will sort it out for you speedily, politely, well. No, that's not the case. I have personal experience that that's not the case. Listen to podcast past. But Ofgem has blasted the energy firm's customer service, saying consumers deserve more in its call for reform of the market. Now, the news comes as one of the largest energy firms, OVO, has come under fire again from hundreds of customers for allegedly getting their bills wrong. Now, the regulators say a third of us are unhappy with the customer service that we get from our energy companies. Helen, why so bad? What are some of the cases, some of the examples? I won't give my own, but I'll just say it went on for about a year. Eventually, they wiped off my entire year's energy consumption, which was lovely. I got an apology. I didn't get money going to charity, which is what I asked for. But anyway, Helen, I'm not the only one. Lots of people are getting really rubbish service. That's if you can even find the number to call to get in contact with anyone.
Yeah, exactly. So I'm really surprised that it's only a third of people that say they're unhappy with the service they've got from their energy firm, because we've been hearing about this for years. One of the main issues that people talk about is just the energy firm purely not picking up the phone. You know, it still takes absolutely hours in some cases to get through to a real person at your energy company, which just isn't good enough, really. You know, energy bills have always been going up for quite some time, people having all sorts of issues, and firms should know by now that people are having a lot of problems and they need to speak to them. But there's still these hugely ridiculous long call waiting times. They know this is an issue. The energy firms have certainly got plenty of money to put more staff on and kind of sort out their helplines, and they just haven't done it. So a lot of them are only contactable 9 to 5. Obviously, it's difficult for people who have a job. They all say they're quite bad at spotting customers who maybe need some, you know, vulnerable customers. It seems like they just kind of have a blanket approach towards everyone. And it's just not acceptable, really, in my opinion. Another thing is they're trying to foist everyone onto these chat bots. So now if you go and try and get, it's one of my real bugbears, because I'd say I'm a fairly tech savvy person, but the few times I've tried to contact not just an energy company, but, you know, other types of, you know, broadband companies and anyone really, the first point of contact, they make it so difficult to find a phone number that sometimes you're like, all right, I'll give the chatbot a go. They're absolutely useless. It takes so long to even get through to a real person. You know, you have to go through all these generic responses, like it takes so long, and they don't seem to have any answers to any actual questions. Like if you go beyond something completely basic, they just can't answer you. Ran over, but energy firms not doing very well. Ofgem has blasted them, told them they need to improve. Don't know why Ofgem didn't tell them this before, because it's been going for quite some time, but Ofgem have now come out and said, you know, you really need to do better.
Lee Boyce, Ofgem in the news quite a bit this week. We'll get into profits a little bit later on and how the energy firms can probably afford to pay for a bit more customer service. But a few sort of suggestions from Ofgem this week. How are they going to make sure that the entire market works better for us? Because I don't think a lot of people feel that it is.
I think at the moment we're in this kind of position in which we're seeing wholesale prices fall. And we've seen the price cap come lower from the start of this month. But I still feel like a lot of power is in the hands, so to speak, of the energy firms, in terms of most people at the moment have been shunted on variable rates, right? So, you know, the competition just hasn't kind of come out again with fixed deals and fixed rates and that kind of thing. So we're still paying a lot for our energy, and we're going to feel that more as winter comes up. Now, Ofgem, I've done this report, you know, talking about all of the energy fads, but I've tried to push the regulator before to kind of name and shame the worst offenders. So, you know, there should be a kind of league table of this is how long a call wait time is at British Gas, at Octopus, at OVO, at all of the, you know, the main ones. So you can kind of make a decision as a customer going, oh, I don't really want to be with them anymore then, if that's how long it's going to take for me to call up if I've got a problem. So Ofgem, I've come up with solutions such as 24-hour helplines. You know, people, you can lose your electricity at all sorts of random times in the day and it might be a problem. And if you can't get hold of someone, you know, it's not great. And as Helen said, if you can only call during office hours, then it's, you know, not ideal. Chatbots, don't get me started on the chatbots. I mean, honestly, such useless technology, really is. Like, I was going to say it's kind of in its infancy, but it's not. And I just don't think anything's improved on that regard. The one thing that Ofgem didn't really put, which Ofgem was quite punchy in this report, you know, it kind of was quite critical of a lot of the major firms, and clearly it has an eye on what's going on. And not to defend some of these major firms, but we have seen the market squeezed in terms of a lot of energy firms have gone under, and a lot of the bigger firms have had to hoover up the customers and getting them onto the billing systems and taking on a whole host more of customers. You know, it isn't a simple thing that just sort of happens overnight. So I can kind of understand it in a way, but as part of the conditions of taking over, you know, millions of customers from a fouled energy firm, you think that Ofgem would say, well, the requirement is you're going to need to take on X amount more call center staff. You're going to need to make sure that, you know, the billing system is sorted within the next, you know, a time frame. And it feels like some of that just hasn't properly happened. And I think that in this Ofgem report, they didn't really talk about the misbilling issues. And the misbilling issues are something that we're hearing about more and more and more. And it's never been so vital to check your energy bills, because I think more so than ever before, people are really clued up on how their energy bill is made up. So how much you're paying per wattage hour, for example. I reckon more people know that than ever before, a rough ballpark figure. I reckon probably 5 years ago, no one had any idea really how much the standing charge is. And you know, roughly, usually, how much you're going to spend on a monthly basis. It gets a little bit skewed because, you know, October rolls around, you start putting the heating on, and then you get a little bit confused as to how much gas you're using and how much you were using last winter and that kind of thing. So it can get all a little bit muddled, but you genuinely usually know how much you are spending on your energy bill. And if it goes wrong, it's just too much of a hassle to try and get it fixed. And it feels like there's a real computer says no mentality when it comes to billing, almost like there's no way this computer and algorithm could be wrong. And that's what we found in this investigation that Helen's done on OVO, which all came about from a crane on the case a little while back, in which she reported on someone's billing issue. And she's opened a whole can of worms when it comes to OVO.
Well, Helen, spill the can of worms.
Yeah, exactly. So this all started, as Lee said, a couple of months ago, when a lady got in touch who said she basically just didn't understand her energy bills from OVO. She sent me over the bills and I had a look at them and I couldn't understand them either. The numbers literally didn't add up. There was things like they'd put in a bill adjustment, hundreds of pounds, absolutely no explanation for why. It seemed like she said they were just plucking numbers out of thin air. And I agreed, and I went to them, and they kind of, she what the thing she really wanted was to switch. So we kind of sorted that out for her. But then after that story was published, hundreds of people got in touch to say that they'd had the same issues with OVO. So that was in early June. And since then, I've had about 400 people get in touch to say essentially the same thing. My OVO bills don't make sense. It seems to me, I think OVO would possibly dispute this, but the issue seems to have started when OVO bought SSE. I think that was a year or so ago, maybe a bit more than a year. And all the customers were transferred over. And it seems to me that from then, something seems to have gone wrong, because so many people are saying their direct debits were hiked by hundreds of pounds a month. You know, their usage hadn't changed. Obviously, bills have kind of got more expensive, but these changes are way out of whack with anything that they were kind of used to paying. And yeah, people have just said it doesn't make sense. And when I tell them it doesn't make sense, they're not listening. They seem to be, in many cases, just saying, oh, you know, energy bills are high now, so that's what you have to pay. So I went to OVO with all of these cases. I asked them to look at a few specifically. For example, there was a lady and her daughter who'd been charged about £4,000 more than they thought they owed. And wow. Exactly. I mean, these are huge sums of money in some cases. And they really, you know, went back and forth for a really long time saying, look, we really don't think we owe this. And they were just told, no, you do. It's because you didn't put in a meter reading for ages, so now you owe this money. And they were trying to tell them this just didn't make sense. And it seems like they just didn't listen. And in the end, they borrowed £3,000 from a relative to pay off that OVO bill, which they still didn't think they owe, just because they were so desperate to switch. They did switch in the end. And when I got in touch, OVO has paid them back all of the money that they were wrongly charged. So it's clear that things are going very wrong here.
What have OVO said to you?
Their response was fairly unhelpful. They said, we've looked into these cases with urgency. We're very sorry for shortfalls in service, and our teams are here to help. So they haven't addressed, you know, I asked them what was going on, why this was happening, and they didn't provide answers to those questions. I've made them fully aware that there are many, many customers with lots of issues, and they just seem to be saying, oh, sorry. They haven't even really admitted that they made mistakes.
Didn't
really
they get done by Ofgem though for overcharging?
They did. So this was earlier in the year. I think it was 11,000 customers. They'd made mistakes with applying the government energy price cap. So people had paid more than they were supposed to, and they refunded quite a lot of customers. They think it was something like £180 each on average. So they've already been kind of pulled up for getting things wrong. But obviously they have many, many more customers than that 11,000. And from the people that have got in touch with me, it seems like this has affected many more people. And actually that issue, that only applied from, I think, 2022 to March 2023. The people who have got in touch with me, many people have had issues that they say have gone on post March 2023. So it seems to me like whatever's going wrong hasn't been addressed.
So what do you do? What do you do if you think that your bill is wrong? Don't go on a chatbot or call up their customer service. That's not going to be very fruitful.
Yeah, it's really difficult. The thing that makes me angry about all of this is that if your bills don't really make sense, it's so hard to pinpoint exactly why, because you don't really get a lot of information on an energy bill. They don't tell you, you know, if they've adjusted your balance, they don't tell you why. They just say this has happened. And the kind of vagueness of the bill, it makes it really difficult to pinpoint exactly what. And that's what I found when looking at people's bills. The numbers have changed, but there's no, you know, you can't explain why. You just, as Lee said, you know what your energy bill should be, and you know that it isn't right. Obviously, the first step is to go to the energy company. Unfortunately, you may have to wait quite a long time to speak to them on the phone. Go to them, you know, tell them, show them past bills, say, this is what I used to pay. Why has it changed so much? And really kind of force them to give you an explanation. You might well not get that. The next step is to ask to escalate it, you know, classic, can I speak to your manager? You can write a letter to the chief executive. Sometimes that works with companies. They'll escalate you to a sort of executive complaints department. And in some cases that can work. If not, go to the ombudsman. You know, that's the kind of final resort. There are time limits on how long it has to be from when you've made a complaint to the company to when you can go to the ombudsman. So it's not ideal, but that's the kind of last resort. But yeah, I think it's really difficult for people to know what to do, especially if the firms aren't being helpful when it comes to contacting them and getting things sorted out. And unfortunately, there's no easy answer that I can give to say, you know, this is how you sort it out, because it just seems like an absolute disaster.
It's a real hodgepodge sometimes, isn't it? Energy bills and the way it's calculated, and if you've got it on direct debit and the estimated bills and all of that kind of thing. And if you change provider, then inevitably quite often there's problems like you've just outlined there. And I think it sometimes it is just an absolute minefield. You move home, for example, and then trying to sort the energy bills out is one of the most frustrating experiences. You've gone through all the rigmarole of moving home, either into a new rental property, and the previous people aren't all the way up to date with the bills, and or you buy a new home and you're with an energy provider you don't want to be with, and you switch. It's just all rigmarole that people don't need. It feels like it needs to be a more streamlined process. And just going back to that, to the OVO story, Georgie, I think that we're really onto something here, because 400 readers getting in touch with us on a certain issue is pretty high. That's a really quite big number for a story like this, all snowballed from one story that Helen had written about. And Helen posted it on, can I say Twitter or do I say X now? Posted it on social media, and you know, it completely blew up. Loads of people getting in touch saying this has happened to me. You know, lots of people read that. So there's obviously something going on. But I think the thing that's most galling about the story is that I hate it when it has to take our involvement to get things sorted. A company has a chance to, sort problems out at source. Instead, it feels like the attitude of some of the staff that we've heard from some of the readers that have got in touch with us just hasn't been right. You know, just to say, no, the bill's right, you know, without any kind of probing or investigation, despite, someone phoning up, a customer phoning up saying, I really, really don't think this is right. Can you give it a proper probe, a proper investigation? And it just feels that it's falling short and that's not happening. Do they have enough staff? Have they taken over SSE and it's taken, you know, its toll and they're basically stretched? We don't know. It's really hard to find out, because the spokesperson that got back to Helen just hasn't really been that helpful either. So we're kind of in the dark too. It feels like we're all in the dark trying to figure out what's going on. Now, Helen has sent this dossier of reader complaints over to Ofgem. So Watchdog is fully aware that there's a lot of people that seem to be in this boat. Hopefully they are properly looking into it. I think Helen's probably got another tranche of emails to send over today. Sometimes journalism, Georgie, the background, it is just admin. It is, you get a reader, get in touch, you have to get all of their info, all of their permission to speak to a press office, all that kind of thing. It takes so much time to do all of this. We'd much rather that companies just treat people fairly. And it just does not seem to be the case at the moment with OVO. And Helen will keep an eye on us and keep going and seeing what other absolute monstrous bills that people are getting that make no sense. I mean, how can you say all of a sudden your bill's $4,000? You phone up, and say, my bill's never been $4,000. Like, what's this all about? No, that bill's right. There's no way that bill could be wrong. You'd be like, hold on. And say, instantly, I'd be worried. You know, if you are, and especially if you're someone that's vulnerable, if someone that's old, you know, someone that doesn't know how to fight this stuff, you'd be kind of living like with a cloud under your head. And if it takes 2 weeks to resolve, that's too long. You know, but if it takes up to a year to resolve, imagine that just hanging over your head, thinking you've got a bill of thousands of pounds that you cannot pay. And that's what I think the nub of this Ofgem report was about. Essentially, people aren't getting the right support. And I'm talking about all energy firms here. If something goes wrong, is there enough support? There should be, you've got a shock bill, there should just be a helpline you straight away get through to and just be like, I'm really worried about this bill. Like, you know, it's a lot of money for a lot of people if something like that happens. And then you're kind of hit with a myriad of, oh, computer says it's right. So it's not the attitude.
No, it's not indeed, Lee. It's not indeed. In the context of everything you've said, Lee and Helen, it's just massively galling for customers, for all of us to read energy firms' profits going through the absolute roof. I mean, one, we are paying out of our ears. I don't know the expression. Is that right? Do you pay out of your nose or your ear, whatever? We're paying a lot of money for our energy bills and they're making big profits, but also not, don't seem to be putting those profits to helping their customers. So British Gas this week announced first half adjusted operating profit surged by 889%. Yes, you heard that right. 889% from 98 million to 969 million. Now, Centrica's UK retail supplier enjoyed its highest ever first half profit after Ofgem permitted it and other providers to claw back more cash from household bills. How did Ofgem permit a profit surge of 889%? Lee Boyce, you were not happy when I was reading that out.
Well, the semantics of it are just wrong, aren't they? It just sounds absolutely terrible, given everything that's been going on, given the fact that we've all got higher energy bills, given the fact that millions of people are with British Gas. A lot of people that are with British Gas are legacy customers that have been with them for decades. When Mike, our city editor, sent around his news list yesterday and it said 889% profit surge at British Gas, I kind of went back and said, have you missed a dot there somewhere? Or 889%. I mean, that is crazy. That is a crazy profit jump, you know, almost £1 billion of profit in the first half compared to 98 million, you know, in comparison in the last half. So, I mean, that is, yeah, I mean, Georgie, it really doesn't look good, does it? That for me does not look good. Whatever way you spin it, yes, energy bills are now falling for people. But as we were talking about recently, we've lost the government help coming up this winter. It's really hard to kind of defend a profit jump that big. You know, it's a business. It's there to make money. Understand that. But this feels like a big, big, big jump. Now, we've got Richard Newdeg of Uswitch in this story sort of explaining what's gone on. And he said, when looking at profits in the energy retail market, all roads lead back to the price cap. So over 29 million households are currently on tariffs set by the price cap. Because of this, suppliers are led to pricing in almost the exact same way, underpinned by similar hedging strategies. The strong supplier profits now possible under the energy price cap as part of the current regulatory environment are driving increasingly fewer incentives for suppliers to innovate and offer cheaper competitive deals that would otherwise bring prices down. So it's kind of what I was mentioning earlier. It feels almost now that we've talked about this for a long time with the price cap, even before all of these energy rises. It's almost like that's the target price. And it's kind of, why would you offer any lower than that when you know that price point's in people's minds? Even if you could offer bills at lower than that, if no one else is doing it, why, no other suppliers are doing it, why would you do it? And this is a question that we have put to the energy suppliers. When are fixed tariffs coming back? And all we've had is tumbleweed, essentially, in reply. But this is where profits are being made. They're creaming off some of the energy price cap stuff. And Ofgem, if it has any sense, would be thinking to itself, okay, we're the regulator. People, the public, are going to be pretty peeved at 889% profit growth, unless you're an investor and you're not a British Gas customer, but you've got shares in it, which plenty of people do have shares in it, yeah, because the share price didn't do too badly off that profit jump. And say, what is going on here? Like, how has a profit gone from this to this in such a short space of time? This doesn't look good. What's going on? And I think that Ofgem has got some serious questions to answer off the back of that profit jump this week.
To just sort of caveat, and no disrespect to the gentleman from Uswitch, but Uswitch obviously makes its profits from people switching around. So they obviously would like more movement in the market. But what do you make of it, or what should be done? I mean, you can look at profits, but then it goes back to the same old argument. This is a business and it's been allowed to run this way. I mean, unless we sort of take things back into the government hands, which I don't know that many people would be that enthused about. So, I mean, what's the solution here? What do we do?
I mean, I don't think people really generally, people don't mind companies making money. I mean, that's what they're here for. But one of the things that really annoyed me about this story, so Chris O'Shea, who's the chief exec of Centrica, he said, nothing's more important than delivering for our customers. It's why we're here. I mean, that's just not really true. Nothing is more important than making money. You're a business. And that's fine. That's what you're there for. But you have to have some level, if you're making these giant profits, I mean, that's just a joke. You have to have some level of kind of improved help or support for your customers. So he said the profits allow them to increase their customer support package to more than 100 million. I mean, that sounds like a big number, but it's really not, because that's not much more than 10% of this massive profit jump, which is just for the first half of this year, and that's across all of their customers. I mean, a start would be to massively increase their support package, which is the money they set aside to help customers who are really struggling and really vulnerable. That would be a start, you know, double it, triple it, help people. And I think Ofgem maybe needs to look at those support packages. You know, it's part of what people pay for through their energy bills. Part of what you put in goes towards those kind of support systems. You know, the company should just add in more from their own profits, in my mind. I know they've got shareholders to answer to, but it just seems like they could be doing an awful lot more. And the thing is, like, the energy crisis isn't going to go on forever. This is going to be, I don't know, a couple more years maybe of people really struggling with their bills. They're making huge money off this, but they will get back to normal. And, you know, why not put a chunk of this money? This is quite a one-off situation. Put some money into it. Like, this isn't going to be forever. You're not going to have to do this forever. But it's quite a specific kind of crisis situation. Well, why not put some more cash in, I think?
That's it for part one.
I'm now joined by Sam Moore from eToro for our weekly look at what's been happening on the markets. So, Sam, what's been going on this week?
Hi, Lee. Yeah, I said last week, if we can get to today and be flat or positive in the markets, then it's super positive. And we have. The Dow Jones has had over 13 days positive in a row, which is a record not seen for many, many years. The S&P 500, the Nasdaq are also set to finish positive the week, as well as the DAX, the FTSE, the Hang Seng, and the Nikkei. We overcame some hawkish central bank moves too, as well. The FOMC raised rates by 25 basis points in what is probably seen as the last hike that they will do. However, we do have over 50 days until the next meeting in September. So they're data dependent. Things can change. It probably is a little bit early to rule anything out. The ECB also raised interest rates, but now they also move to a data dependent route for any further hikes. We also saw Japan take their first baby steps in their journey of their monetary tightening process, which will be really one to watch, I think. Earnings were mixed. Microsoft came under pressure, but Meta pushed higher and Google wasn't too bad either. All in all, the bulls are happy. The bears are certainly not.
And what's on the radar for next week?
Yeah, we've got some big earnings coming out, which we'll get into in a moment. But just to first talk about the key data points we have. GDP and inflation numbers out of Europe, more policy decisions across the board from Australia and the UK, and a jobs report from both Canada and the United States to wrap it all up. Earnings wise, we've got some big ones. Apple, Amazon on Thursday, they'll be the key one from investors to keep an eye on. Also PayPal, Pfizer, Starbucks, Shopify, they all report. And as mentioned, they'll have the attention of individual investors, but also the broader market too. It's another big week. But it's probably worth noting, after we get through next week, things will probably start to slow down a little bit and summer season takes full effect.
Thank you very much. That's Sam North from eToro.
Thanks, Lee.
Welcome back. More of us are moving our bank accounts. 1.2 million switched last year, according to Current Account Switching Service. And the winner is Crisis Hit NatWest. And I think in second place was HSBC. So, Lee Boyce, why are we switching? Is it for the money? And why to NatWest?
Oh, it's for the money. It is for the money, Judy. There is absolutely no beating around the bush.
Don't say that. When you ask people why they're switching, it's all like, I want a better customer service and stuff. Is it about the switching? But what are switching bonuses, Lee?
They're lying. They're just going for the money. This actual current account switching data, which is for the banks, is from the first 3 months of the year, is a real highlight of this, because NatWest was offering £200 and it's a really quite a fast payment. It comes at the moment, they've got a switching deal on, a newly launched one, which is not quite £200 and it's 150 quid, but that comes within 3 days. So not only have we seen the carrots getting bigger, we're seeing the payment terms coming down quite a lot. So to get the cash within 3 days without really having to do much, you know, usually you've got to pay in a certain amount of money, you've got to have direct debit set up, you've got to do pay salary and all that kind of stuff. All of the goalposts have been kind of shifted a little bit to make it easier, and I think more people are just going for it, thinking, do you know what, let's do it. And if you're smart, if you're really smart, Georgie, and this is what I do, but don't tell anyone
because you're really smartly
Yeah, well, I am. I am when it. No, I'm not. I am when it comes to current account switching, though, because
no doubt.
Have a second account. So I've got my main account, which I get my salary in, which I've had for many years. Got my direct debits, all that kind of thing. But then I have a second account that I usually use for like holiday spending and all that kind of stuff. And then just use it to do all the switches. So, you know, I'm not having to switch my main account and just switch your second account and get the cash and then move on to the next one. You can usually do it once or twice a year. You have to be careful because quite often bank won't let you do it for like 3 years or something like that. Yeah. So you have to read what I'm trying to say is you've got to read the terms and conditions. You can't just like jump from one account to another every couple of months. You can usually do like one or two a year to stick within the rules. And also
stipulations like you need sort of two direct debits going out of that account.
Yeah, exactly. You've got to read the T's and C's. And also just remember if you're just opening current accounts and stuff all the time on your credit rating and all that kind of stuff. So if you're smart, like once is probably enough. But to get 200 quid off of a secondary account, you know, it can be worth it. Yeah. What's happened here in this current account switching report is that I think really interestingly, the 3 months before this, Nationwide absolutely had a barnstorming 3 months. So it was offering incentive, a couple of £100. It was the biggest incentive it ever offered. And then lo and behold, January to March, when it wasn't offering it, it lost the most amount of customers. Who use the current account switching service because it wasn't offering an incentive and people are clearly moving their money around or clearly just opening accounts to bag it. So it was quite interesting with the NatWest one because obviously everything that's been going on, experienced staff losing their jobs and quitting, etc., in the wake of the Coutts scandal. But NatWest managed to get 45,000 net current account switches. And as you say, HSBC was second, almost 29,000. That includes First Direct as well. Then Lloyds,
deal, I remember.
And then Lloyds, then RBS, then Santander. So all the big main banks who've been offering incentives have managed to hook people in. Now, this week,
big banks as well. I was surprised it was the big banks. There wasn't
to be fair, usually this is dominated by Monzo's and the Starlings, but they never offer incentives. They maybe reached the peak of where they're getting in terms of the current accounts, which is also the other interesting thing that's happened in recent times. A couple of the banks have decided to scrap overseas fees. So for example, First Direct, that big boon about Starling was that it was a great account to go and use in Europe if you were going to go on holiday, fee-free spending. But if some of these banks now, HSBC, First Direct, are offering fee-free spending overseas with HSBC, you have to get the global money card. But they're little things that might be just like nipping into the challenges, so to speak. But I was going to say the big banks is quite telling because we were just talking about Centrica and its bumper profits, but all the big banks have reported big bumper profits, half year profits this week, mainly because base rates been going up, the cost of borrowing is going up, their interest margins are growing, net interest margins are growing, and banks are creaming more money off their customers. So no wonder they're offering incentives to get you to come across to be a current account customer, because a lot of the time you become a current account customer and then you end up doing other things with your bank. You get a mortgage with them, a credit card, a loan, all that kind of stuff. That's what they're banking on. So while it might look, oh, a nice couple of £100, there's a reason. It's not like they're doing it out of the goodness of their heart. They want you to become a fully fledged banking customer with it. And it's telling this that we've gone from, as I say, Nationwide and just absolutely cutting that and suffering as a result. They lost a net 34,000 customers. Actually, Monzo was lost the fourth highest amount and lost a net 7,600. Is the Monzo madness boom over? According to the current account switching, it might be. It's just people are just following the money.
Yeah, it's interesting because, so Lee, clearly you switch around for money. I actually did my first switch. God, I was with my bank for 18 years or something. And I did a switch to actually Starling. I did, because it was voted like best bank and they didn't offer me any incentive to go, apart from the fact there were a few moral issues with the current bank that I was with and I wasn't particularly enthused about staying. So I went, look at me. So you're super intelligently, I'm moral. No, Helen, have you switched and the reason for it?
So I'm actually slightly embarrassed to admit this as a money journalist. I've never switched my current account, but I will explain why. So I have a Nationwide current account. I opened it when I was 16. And the only reason I have a Nationwide account is because it was the only bank that had a branch in the little town in the Midlands where I grew up. So that's why I started it. You know, it wasn't really another option, no choice. However, the reason I've kept it, and I think this is an important point, you know, it's great that banks are offering these cash incentives for people who want to switch, but I think you do have to really think about the customer service. So the reason, pretty much the only reason I've stayed with Nationwide is because a few years ago, my car got cloned and someone in the US tried to take out a massive amount of money from my current account, would have like wiped out my overdraft, like thousands of pounds. And I got a call from Nationwide instantly. Are you in New York? No, I'm not in New York. Okay, well, someone's trying to take out a massive amount of money from your account. We'll just stop it. I was like, do I have to do anything? No. Cool. Great. Done. No problem. And I just think that was so, having heard so many horror stories about people getting money taken from their account, nothing left my account. One call. Was this you? No. Fine. Perfect. And I just think like that experience was so good. I will just stay with them. I think the way that banks react in like a crisis scenario is just, it's just a really good experience. So I was like, you know what, I'm actually perfectly happy to stay with you. So I just have.
I think that's fair enough. Sticking with banking, we're not going to go down the Nigel Farage thing. Look, it's been done to death. But what I think is important about the case is it has highlighted the issue of being debanked, or, you know, your bank account frozen, or, you know, a bank closing your account, often not telling you why. Now, there are reasons that that could be the case if there's a criminal investigation ongoing, et cetera, but often they've used that as a bit of a shroud as to why they have closed it, as we're finding out. But Helen, you've been investigating cases like this for a while, even before this all blew up. So, you know, tell us more.
Yeah, this is something I hear about from readers quite regularly, and I think it's kind of ramped up in the last couple of years. So not something new, although it's obviously in the news at the minute. This is something that does unfortunately happen. The story that I've written this week, it's something I've actually been working on for a few months. So this person came to me in May, way before all of this debanking debacle kind of blew up. It's actually a really sad story. So she got in touch on behalf of her parents-in-law. They had their only current account. It was a joint current account with HSBC, only bank account they'd had for years. One day the account was closed down. They had all their money in it. It was about £35,000. They were also, it was the account that they paid their pensions into, so they weren't able to get their pensions. So real crisis for them. Their daughter-in-law described them as sheltered and vulnerable. You know, they're older people. Mm. They live in a rural part of the country. They don't have the internet, various kind of health issues. So really vulnerable people. And basically it's taken HSBC from December until now to get them sorted out with another current account. So we don't know why their account was closed. This is always the case in these kind of issues. The bank will say, you know, we no longer wish to offer you current account services, and they don't explain why. So they have all banks have a generic list of reasons why they might close your account, and it's things like suspected fraud, unusual activity. Banks also, I think, have certain rules about how many people they can have current accounts for who are in a certain kind of risk bracket, but it's all these kind of opaque rules that they don't really fully explain. And it tends to be, you know, well, this is our decision, and there's nothing you can do about it. So this couple, this happened to them. They didn't tell anyone for a month. They were living on food out of the freezer because they genuinely didn't have any money. Finally told their daughter-in-law about it. She was like, well, you know, we'll go and speak to them and we'll get you another account. They were just trying to set up a basic account, which is a kind of current account that you have if you maybe wouldn't qualify for a mainstream current account for whatever reason. You know, that most people should be able to get that. And it just ridiculous back and forth. You know, they didn't have the right ID. So this lady had to get her mother-in-law, who's very elderly, a provisional driving license. You know, the husband wasn't able to go to the bank because he has health issues. He finds it's difficult to walk. And that delayed it for months. They offered these people absolutely, they were clearly very vulnerable. They turned up to the branch in despair saying, we can't afford to eat. And HSBC just faffed about for months, like trying to make them go through all these hoops and leaving them with no money. I mean, what people will probably say when they read this is, could they not go to a different bank? The issue they had was obviously the mother-in-law didn't have the right ID, and HSBC is one of the only banks that will accept a provisional driving license as ID. So they're kind of stuck with HSBC. I just think it's completely unacceptable. Like, why didn't they help them? I just find it absolutely mind-boggling.
And the upshot was?
So when I got in touch, they did manage to open them a basic bank account. And I heard from them a couple of weeks ago, the check that they had with all their money on it has now been paid into their new account. So they have the money back, they're getting their pensions again. But even between May, when I started talking to HSBC, and now, that's still another, you know, that's 2 months where HSBC still was going back and forth. I really think, how difficult is it to open someone a basic bank account? They should have been able to do that almost immediately. You know, it's difficult because, you know, these are elderly people, but they did their absolute best. You know, they went in, they filled out forms, then they told them they were the wrong forms. I mean, banks should be able to help elderly people. Like, I mean, having a bank account is an essential service. You can't do without a bank account. I mean, it should be, you know, water companies can't cut your water off because it's so essential. I would argue that unless you've committed some kind of massive fraud, your bank should offer you a basic bank account if the alternative is you are left with literally no money. I mean, it just boggles the mind, in my opinion.
It does indeed. Let's move on. Finally, Lee, more estates having to pay inheritance tax. And let's be honest, that figure is only likely to get more as the threshold is frozen to at least 2028. The latest data showed an annual rise of 17% as the government took almost 6 billion in the 2020 to 21 tax year. Disputes are also on the rise, especially as families become more complicated, more blended. So Lee Boyce, what are the latest inheritance tax figures show? Also speculation that it could be scrapped. Is that likely when we're looking at figures of 6 billion for the Treasury?
Yeah, I mean, we've spoken about inheritance tax a fair amount on the podcast, haven't we, Georgie? One of those taxes where, you know, you could argue that very few people pay it, but lots of people hate it, despite the fact that they probably won't end up getting caught in the inheritance tax web. But more people are, and that's what these figures are showing. So,
only 27,000, Lee, which actually I don't think that is, you know, when you've got a country of how many millions? It's 27,000 paid it last year, I think.
I think the thing is with it, though, is that it's become a kind of more of a middle class tax trap now than it ever was before. It wasn't really set up in the way it's sort of behaving now. 27,000, that compares to 15,000 a decade ago. So it's almost a doubling of people that are getting hooked in with inheritance tax bills because the threshold has been frozen. And, you know, people basically, it's a fiscal drag. People are getting dragged into it and property prices have been going up. And the majority of people that pay it are in London and the South East. Now, we could argue to the hilt whether or not we believe this tax to be fair. I think that it is a very unfair tax in terms of it quite often punishes people for being successful, which I think is just a little bit, it feels a bit outdated in a way, in my mind. And I think that at the end of the day, there is this mooted government talking about scrapping the entire thing, you know, absolute like kite flying sort of talks about this. Let's just get rid of it. You know, but as you say, it's raking in almost £6 billion. That figure's probably gone up quite considerably since that year as well, because this is 2020-2021 financial year we're talking about. Why does it always have to be sort of like hell or high water? Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like, let's just scrap it. Instead of just thinking, do you know what is it that fundamentally people don't like about this tax? And what can we do, you know, tinker with it so that actually people that you know, can afford to pay it or should potentially pay it, if you want to argue it, is that, you know, should it be cut to 20%, for example? Mm. Should the threshold be pushed up to reflect higher house prices? And the loopholes that lots of high net worth individuals, I'm talking about people that are multimillionaires, I'm not just talking about someone that's bought a home in the home counties, you know, 40 years ago and never expected that property to be worth more than £1 million. The loopholes that they use to sort of get away with potentially not paying much inheritance tax anyway, those are the things I would be thinking about more so than just, well, let's just get rid of it. Let's see what the voters think about that. Let's just get rid of it. Yeah. You know, why can't there be a sort of halfway house where there's actually just a conversation where they go, I think there's going to be some reforms needed in inheritance tax. We've frozen the threshold till 2028. That's annoying people. Yeah,
I would suggest, that's a very political.
It's very political.
Desperate move by the Conservatives looking to go to their heartlands quite drastic to get people out to vote. I would suggest it's that. I don't think this is a very likely thing. I mean, you probably won't get a Conservative government to even implement that, but I would be surprised if that would ever be the case. But then reforming any tax seems to take everyone forever.
Oh yeah, it would just take forever. That's why it was just so bizarre just to say it was going to get rid of it. I mean, yeah. Anyway, the thing that actually is quite interesting though, and as you just touched on there, is this whole thing around inheritances and blended families. So getting away from inheritance tax stuff, there's been a real rise in people writing mirror wills. Now, mirror wills are basically, if you're married, you mirror each other's will. So say you've got children, one of you passes away, you've just got exactly the same will, it all goes to you, and then you've written the will together as a mirror will and it's going to go to the children. Now what's happening is that a lot of people are in blended families. It's estimated something like 1 in 3 families are blended now, and that means that, you know, your parents, for example, have remarried, they've divorced and they've remarried, and now you've got step parents, and it starts to get more complicated. You've got step siblings, all of that kind of stuff. And we actually had a case that was written in Financial Man on Sunday this weekend by Jessica Beard. It's a really good story. Well, it's a sad story in which this lady's mum remarried, said that she was going to inherit all of her worldly goods. So we're not talking about vast, quite often I think we talk about inheritance, people think talking about massive sums of money, you're talking about properties, you're talking about this, that and the other. Quite often people just have sentimental value on things that, you know, with your parents, and you'd quite like to keep hold of some of it for sentimental value and that kind of thing. So this lady's mother remarried, she had a stepfather, she was only child, told that the family fortune was going to come to her and all of the goods and all that kind of stuff, drawn up this mirror will, she passed away, stepdad. Then the problem with these mirror wills is they can be rewritten once a spouse has passed away. Now that is a fundamental flaw, I believe, that a whole will could then be rewritten. And the stepfather gave away the whole wealth, all of it, to the cleaner. There's absolutely nothing this lady can do about it. That was in the will. He'd rewritten the will. She had no idea. There's those kinds of stories are becoming way more mainstream now. Mm-hmm. It usually more involves stepchildren, for example. So I don't know absolutely every single in and out of this case, but let's say the stepfather had children, you know, there's nothing stopping him from rewriting the will. And that's where a lot of these problems are coming in. So it's a real, real kind of messy world we're in when it comes to wills. I think lots of people put it off. Lots of people just think, oh, it'll all be all right, you know, do a mirror will, that's all locked in, it's all done. But then if your wishes are changed in the years that go after you've passed away, it's absolutely, I mean, I can't even imagine how you'd feel. Yeah, I mean, and she was told, you know, if you want to buy some of your mum's old stuff, you can just buy it on the auction site where all this is all going. It's like, God, how heartless is that? I mean, it's just, yeah, horrible, horrible, horrible story. Yeah, and it shows the complication around wills and inheritance and what can arise. It's a really powerful story. I'd well recommend reading it.
Lee, do you remember a couple of weeks ago you had a pop at me for ending the pod on a quite serious story? Well, look at you now.
Well, listen, it's a serious story, but also it's one of those things, if it gets you thinking about, you know, your own will, your parents' will and all that kind of stuff, that's a good thing. No?
Yeah.
Spin it into something good.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, all right then. All right, Lee. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app if you have any comments or questions or thoughts for the team.
Yeah, you can.
Like to look into, Lee?
Yeah, you can X us at thisismoney. And you can also email editor at thisismoney.co.uk. And you can also comment in the podcast article where this will live.
Marvellous. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? Helps other people find us too.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.